Accession number 19921, Reel 1.
Dick Gledhill, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Idle, Bradford, West Yorkshire.
Which year was this?
1920.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Idle?
Yes, I did.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
In 34?
That's right, yes.
Did you get a job?
Immediately, yes.
Doing?
Well, I'm a butcher. I work for our local cooperative society. And I worked in the meat department of our local cooperative society until I got my calling up papers in late May 1940.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did, yes, that Sunday morning, yes. I was at home at the time.
And how did you feel about that?
Well, I think it was fairly obvious that I would be drawn into it quite soon. But I didn't get in as quickly as I thought I may, from September the 3rd to the following May. You know, I thought I'd have been in sooner, really, but...
Can you tell me about joining up, please?
Well, I was 20 in April 1940. So, I suppose it would be fairly quick, really, afterwards, when I got my calling up papers in late May 1940, and I had to go to York. There were three of us, we all knew one another, and we all got our calling up papers to go to York in the battalion at York. Now,
this is the West York.
This is the West Yorkshire Regiment. We trained until very late December, and then a draft was formed to go abroad. By the kit that we got, well, we knew that we were going in the Middle East, and we went in January, very early January. We entrained at York, went up to Gourock in Scotland, and joined the convoy there. Now, when we joined the convoy, we were on the ship almost a week, and I was fairly fortunate, I suppose, in a way, that they wanted some butchers on the ship. Now, when I went to say that I was a butcher, they asked me, would I prepare to look after the bacon and hams for breakfast, bone them out and all this sort of thing, and I said, oh yes. So I did, and for about 4 or 5 days we were on that boat. The following morning, the convoy had left, leaving us who were on the... We were on the Pasteur, a brand new French ship that had only just been commissioned, not all that long, really. Now, this ship, the Pasteur, was named after, of course, the scientist, and, of course, it was on the North Atlantic... It was built for the North Atlantic American run. Now, when this ship was in convoys on two or three occasions, and there was a submarine scare, it set off on its own and left the rest of the convoy at full speed and to go to either to America or come back to England. And when this particular morning, when all the convoy had gone and we were left there, we wondered why. So of course they weren't long in finding out that there were quite a lot of French Vichy crew on the boat, and someone had thrown some buckets of sand in the engines, so we couldn't go. We had to go back to York and await the following convoy, which delayed us probably a good month, if you can understand. It would take some time to form another convoy, and that was it. So the Fiji French didn't do it. Well, I don't know, it might have done us some favours by delaying our going abroad, as it were. But we had to go eventually, within about a month or so.
So this is in 1942?
No, this was in 1941, very early 1941, January 1941. And then, of course, we went on the road. And we went, this time, our boat was the Strathaden. And again, I was fortunate again, because being a signaller, being trained to be a signaller, there was eight of us taken up onto the bridge to do watches, as they call them in the Navy, to run the pennants up when messages were coming in from the destroyers or whatever that was around the convoy. We had to watch the pennants going up. We were straight behind the Commodore boat. The Commodore ship that was in front of us, there was the biggest convoy, and we had to run the pennants up. We used to race each other, each ship used to race each other to run the pennants up. And it was very interesting, was that. I enjoyed doing it. We pulled into Cape Town, and then we continued, after about a week in Cape Town, we continued up to Suez. And then, after that, we'd only been there about a fortnight when we were going to join the 2nd Battalion West Yorks. We were down in Abyssinia, in the 5th Indian Division. And we were stopped from going down, actually, because the war against Mussolini and the Abyssinian army, Italian army, they were coming back because the war had finished. The Italians had been defeated, and then we were very shortly to go up onto the desert. We went up onto the desert, we joined the battalion, and I was in the signal platoon with quite a few other Bradford lads, who I have lost contact with now. One or two of them have died. And of course, a few got killed as well. And we went up on the desert via the battle route. And the battle route, if people who don't know what it is, it was when you got through Cairo and got onto the desert, there was a succession of battles every so far, and you could see these battles. Big battles that were full of sand so they couldn't blow over. And that was the route up onto the desert. And we did what we call jock columns with 3-ton wagons, lorries, and I was taught how to drive a motorcycle, and I did a little bit of DRing in between it all. We were all over the desert, up to the Italian, where the Italians were, and we were searching for in case any other columns were coming round the bottom in the desert, you know, deep into the desert. And this was in 1941, and then round about August in 1941. In northern Iraq, the Kurds began causing trouble. Now, the Germans, who declared war on Russia, were trying to get through the Caucasus, and naturally, they were sympathetic toward the German cause. So they began causing trouble up in northern Iraq. So they sent our division up there. As a show of force, I suppose, because we didn't actually do any fighting when we got there. We may have done, but as it happened, they calmed themselves down, realising that they couldn't defeat the 5th Indian Division. And we went up there. We went up through Baghdad, through Kirkuk, and nearly up to the Turkish border. And we stayed there until late November. We were up there about, 3 months probably.
What kind of things did you see when you were there?
Well, not a lot, because the Kurds had calmed down. But we stayed there. We were among all the oil wells and that sort of thing. Now, whether they intended to do any damage to the oil wells, I don't know. But we didn't actually do any fighting. I think it was a show of force that calmed them down a bit. And then we came back in November. And
to where?
Down through Baghdad into Egypt. And we came through Palestine into Egypt, onto the seashore there. Now, we moved then, thinking that we were going to be going on the desert. We didn't go on the desert. We went to Cyprus, on garrison duties in Cyprus. Now, I was in the rear party, and I arrived on Cyprus at Famagusta on Christmas Eve, 1941. There was some trucks waiting for us. Not a lot. There was only two trucks, really. And they were Indian drivers. And we set off from Famagusta. And I can't remember the name, whether it was either Limassol or Larnaca. But we arrived there that Christmas Eve. And it was getting dark. In fact, the Indian drivers refused to take us any farther than either Limassol or Famagusta. Larnaca. Now, I can't remember which town it was, but they wouldn't drive in the dark because they said it was too dangerous on the cliff tops. So we stayed in this particular town. We managed to get some sandwiches from an army camp. Where could we sleep? Well, they showed us some brand new air raid shelters, all dug underground. And they were ideal, really. And then I went down with a friend. We called him Ginger Hartley. And we went into this town. And being a Christian, I'm a church-going person. And I said, I'd like to go to church. And there was a church open. And so Ginger said, right, well, come on, let's go. So I went to this church service. It could have been a Catholic church, I don't know. But, I mean, I'm a Methodist. My wife's a Catholic. But I went in. And it's the only time I ever went in a church during the war. And I'm glad I did. But...
Why was that? Why were you so glad?
I'm a believer. You see? A Christian. And I wanted to go to church Christmas Eve. So, we came back after that. And we settled down for the night. And the following day, we set off. And we joined the battalion, the 2nd Battalion, West Yorks, who were stationed at Katima, K-T-I-A-M-A, Katima, which is in the district of Paphos. Now, we did garrison duties in that area, plus training, of course. And we stayed there until the back end of March. So we were there about 3 months. Now then, when we came, we moved to Nicosia, the capital of Cyprus, and then from then we went back to Egypt, and we were dive bombed on the boat going from Famagusta to Egypt by an Italian dive bomber that came in a time or two, you know, and he just missed the boat. The boat didn't get hit, but I mean there was every possibility. But anyway, we arrived in Egypt, and then we made our way up onto the desert via Hellfire Pass. It's a very steep, winding road, is that, up onto the top of the escarpment at Hellfire Pass. And we went then up to Tobruk. The fighting on the desert hadn't got so far as Tobruk. Now, so we went into Tobruk, and then we came back out of Tobruk to an airfield near what they called El Adem. El Adem. A-D-E-M, I think it's pronunciation. But anyway, we were going to go into an attack then on the desert because Rommel was coming, you see. He'd arrived in Benghazi. And he attacked through the desert. And this particular morning that we were going to attack, the HLIs, were in 10 Brigade. We were in 9 Brigade, our battalion, with two other Indian battalions. The 1st Battalion HLIs were in 10 Brigade with two other Indian battalions. Now, the HLIs were going to attack their objective at 6 o'clock on June the 1st. Now, this attack was delayed for about 3 or 4 days. And we were told this attack was going to be a piece of cake. They always tell you that. Anyway, when the day came for us to attack, which was, it was a shame it was delayed, because we learned afterwards that if we had have attacked on the 1st of June in 1942, Rommel was running out of petrol and fuel for his tanks and all his transport. But delaying that attack for about 2 or 3 days enabled him to get his all the fuel he needed to the front. And when we did attack, after about 2 or 3 days, I believe we attacked on the 5th of June. And, well, they were waiting. The Germans were waiting, and the Italians. However, the 1st Battalion HLRs were going to attack at 6 o'clock in the morning. And we were then going to attack through the HLIs after they captured their objective at 9 o'clock in the morning. Well, they captured their objective and we went through them, but we were on motorised transport. We were attacking on 3 tonners. And they waved to us and we waved back. And our attack was going up a gradual slope. It was flattish desert. It wasn't, you know, there were no sand dunes, anything like that. It was hard desert on a gradual incline to the top of this rise. Now, it must have been nearly 2 miles. Now, I was with A Company, attached to A Company as a signaller, with the A Company commander in his Jeep. Walter Hull was the driver. And there was the sergeant major, Jerry Davison, second in command, and the A Company's commander's Batman as well, plus myself, with the wireless set. Well, we gradually went up this. We went through a creeping barrage of artillery fire, and our company commander would say to Walter Hulls, "Go over to that truck over there," and he'd drive across, and then he asked to go over to that truck over there, with A Company, and there were on 2 or 3 occasions that these trucks got hit and set on fire. So it was obvious that they were after our Jeep. They must have realised that our company commander was in that Jeep. So when we arrived, we went through this creeping barrage to the top of the hill. And when we got on the top of the rise, we got the orders to debus. Well, we debussed, and I was a bit encumbered with this wireless set. I was trying to find a trench to get into. Couldn't see a trench. And I dived behind some scrub, just to give me, not that it would have stopped me being hit by a bullet, but at least it gave me a little bit of cover. And then I glanced and I looked around and I saw a trench about 50 yards to my right, you know, in front, just on the right there. And I picked the wireless set up, my rifle and that, and I dashed across to this trench, doubled up, and dived straight into it. And I dived straight up to Jerry Dawson, A Company's sergeant major. And he said to me, "Glad Hill," he said, "get yourself down, you're going to get yourself killed." And just then, an explosive bullet splattered into the back of the trench. He said, "There you are," he says, "that's an explosive bullet, and they're supposed to be illegal." I'll never forget him saying that. Well, we stayed in those positions. We captured the objective. We stayed in those positions, holding them for, it was what we call tiffin time, that's lunchtime. And then There were some German tanks. They kept coming up the rise at the other side, onto the brow, and firing and rolling back again. Now, they did this quite a number of times, and there was a plane flying about up there, a spotter plane, a German spotter plane. I said to Jerry Dawson, I said, Sergeant Major, I says, have you seen that up there? He said, yes. We knew what was happening. It appears that we were told that our artillery had been told when the attack went in not to bother digging in their guns, because it was going to be a piece of cake and we'd be going straight forward. You're wasting your time digging the guns in, we'll be going forward. So they didn't dig the guns in. And this spotter plane was sending messages back to the German or Italian artillery, and they counterfired most of our own artillery and knocking them out. So we had no artillery support then. It was terrible, really. But I never saw a single British tank. Not one all the time. So we were there, more or less fighting German tanks with rifles and bayonets. But you can't fight, you can't do that. Now, the thing was that at 1:30 at tiffin time, lunchtime, a runner came round and he said, the brigadier says that your positions are untenable. And at 2:15, which was going to be in 3/4 hour, you'll hear whistles blowing. When you hear the whistle blowing at 2:15, get out of your trenches and walk the way back you've come. Don't bunch together, spread out to avoid casualties. This is the message that this runner had for us all. The brigadier said the positions were untenable. So we waited, and the sergeant major and myself, and at 2:15 the whistles began blowing, and Jerry Dawson said to me, come on, he says, it's down, we were off. So we set off, and we got out of the trenches, and we walked back the way we came. And I don't recall anybody being hit, funnily enough. Probably some were, because there were other companies in the battalion, but I didn't recall anybody being very severely wounded. And we walked back down the slope with the German tanks firing at us, and they were firing what we call leaping leaners. we used to call them leaping leaners. They used to bounce and then up in the air and explode. On a number of occasions this happened. And we walked back about 2 miles, and we saw a truck. In fact, I was right up against the truck. I saw this truck, and a movie cameraman taking film. And he had prisoners, German and Italian prisoners, walking around this truck. I'll never forget it, because it was quite humorous. And he was saying, and thousands of prisoners were taken, and I don't think there were above 200. Well, we laughed, and we kept on moving back. And then that night, we camped that night, on the defensive, of course. And this was the beginning of the withdrawal to Alamein. So I was at the very sharp end of the withdrawal to Alamein. From what I could see, I suppose other units were in the same situation as we were. And this went on for 2 or 3 days, withdrawing gradually. I never saw a route back to Alamein, as I had read in the papers and heard on the television. Sorry, I'm getting mixed up on the wireless. And on the 9th of June, we were there, and it was at tea time, around about 5:30. Our sergeant major, Jim Maloney, who only died about 3 years ago, he said, the battalion commander, Colonel Cree, will be coming round to all companies in the battalion to put you all in the picture. So we want you here for when he comes to HQ. I was in HQ company. So Colonel Cree came, and he got us on three sides, and he stood at the other side, and he told us what we were going to do. we were going to withdraw to Alamein, to the narrowest point on the desert, because the Qatara Depression was inland, and that was going to form a barrier for the Germans as well, against the Germans, because there's nobody could have got through the Qatara Depression. And I believe it was about 90 miles wide was this stretch of country from Alamein. I remember seeing the station at Alamein. It was only just a platform sort of thing. There was no buildings or anything. But that's where we were making for. We were going to be on Ruwaizat Ridge. Now, when Colonel Cree left our HQ, Jim Maloney, our sergeant major, said, right, I want 12 volunteers to load a truck with ammunition. So, they always say in the army, you don't volunteer for anything. So I didn't volunteer. And they only got two volunteers, and they were both dispatch riders out of our platoon. They called one Bethel and the other Morton. And when he saw that there were only two volunteers, he said to Bethel and Morton, right, you two fall out, you can go. You lot off by here, he said, over there, and load that truck with ammunition. So I was the first there, actually. I thought, well, nothing really loading a truck with ammunition. I jumped on the back of the truck, and the other men began handing me up the ammunition for me to load at the front of the truck as neatly as I could, obviously, to get as much on the truck as we could. Well, I'd been doing that for about 5 minutes, and I was bent down, picking with my hands on the carrying handles of a case of mortar bombs. And when I woke up, I was still holding the case of mortar bombs. And I didn't know what had happened. And when I looked, and I was still bent down, and I could see smoke and dust and sand and then I realised there must have been an explosion, but I'd never heard it, because I was so near to it. I'd been knocked out within a split second, because the explosion was so big. Well, I stood up, and that morning, it's silly to say this, but I'd been issued with a new shirt. And I looked down the front of my shirt, and it was all saturated in blood. And I thought, oh, my new shirt. And then I realised, well, what a silly thing to think. But, you know, this is just the first thing that I thought. Anyway, I stood up, and I was in terrible pain. Oh, my back was shocking. I could hardly breathe. And it must, of course, have been by the blast. And Bob Sullivan, one of the stretcher bearers, a very experienced stretcher bearer as well, he shouted, first man there, grab him. And they lifted me off the back of the truck. And through the sand and the dust and all that, they took me at one side where the MO, medical officer, was getting things organised. Now, I didn't know at the time, because, I mean, we didn't know actually how many had been killed. But a man who has since died, Len Manley, lived at Keighley. He said, Dick, he said, I know there was 13 men killed, because he said, I helped to dig the graves. So I said, oh. Well, there were about four of us left who were wounded. And when the MO had seen to us as best he could in the circumstances, that scar on my cheek is the only visible thing that I have left, which was causing, of course, I'm deaf in this ear. Very deaf. You're right.